Chapter 69. Suicide. The police are continually being astonished by some of the strange forms of suicide they encounter. Wendell and Svensson's classic study, Crime Detection, has a description of a man who killed himself by placing the blade of a jackknife against his forehead and then driving it in by beating his head against a tree. It also contains a photograph of the body of an old lady who carefully placed all her furniture in a pile in the middle of the room, lay down on it, and set it on fire. Taylor's Medical Jurisprudence has an even stranger case of a man who burned himself to death by lying down on his mattress and setting it on fire. But as he burned to death, he periodically got up and made notes about his sensations. All healthy creatures loathe the thought of death, so we find such cases incomprehensible. We try to dismiss them by saying, well, they were insane, and we're reassured by the usual coroner's verdict, suicide while the balance of the mind was disturbed. Yet in recent years, criminologists have realised that this simplistic view is false, and that the truth about suicide brings us to the edge of some of the most disturbing and fascinating revelations in the whole field of criminology. Expressed in crudely simple terms, you could say that most psychologists now accept that murder is a form of suicide. Now, at first sight, this seems absurd. Take the case of a bank robber who shoots a policeman in the course of escape, or a rapist who strangles the girl to make sure that she can't identify him. Surely this is a matter of self-preservation rather than suicide. Well, no. The impulse that makes a man capable of murder springs from his indifference to life, to others and to his own. This point is brought out brilliantly in one of the autobiographical sketches of the Russian writer Gorky, describing a murderer called Vasily Merkulov. The case was described to Gorky by the judge, Ellen Sviatukhin. Merkulov was a highly intelligent carter. He was also exceptionally powerful physically. One day, he caught a man stealing sugar from his cart, and he hit him. The force of the blow killed the man. Merkulov was not sentenced to jail for manslaughter. He was sent to a monastery to do penance. But the thought of how easily he had killed the man became an obsession. A kindly priest talked to Merkulov about the importance of repentance, but it struck the carter as absurd. He only had to give this priest one violent blow, and he would also be dead. One day, after his release, Merkulov lost his temper with an idiot girl who was importuning him, and he struck her with a piece of wood. The blow killed her, and Merkulov's obsession deepened. This girl was always falling down or walking into walls and never seemed to hurt herself, and yet one blow had killed her. For this killing, Merkulov served a term in prison. When he came out, the obsession had become a torment. Merkulov's new employer, Ivan Kirillich, was a kindly man, cheerful, good-tempered, and brave. As in the case of the priest, Merkulov was haunted by the thought that one blow could destroy this man and all his good qualities, and one day, in a kind of frenzy, he overpowered his employer, tortured him, and then strangled him. He was captured immediately after the crime. Merkulov committed suicide in prison by strangling himself with his chains. His confession to the judges makes it clear that he wasn't insane, in the ordinary sense of the word. All the time I kept thinking, I can kill any man I choose, and any man can kill me. This is what disturbs him so deeply. And about his first manslaughter, a man was walking along the street, I struck him, and no more man. What does it mean? The soul, where is it? What haunts him is the feeling that if people can die so easily, then life is meaningless. All the religion, all the goodness, all the talk about divine providence and wisdom fail to disguise the fact that man can be snuffed out as easily as an electric light bulb. Presumably, therefore, he has no more soul than a light bulb. But in order to live, human beings have to believe in the future and in the value of what they do and think. Why did Merkulov kill his employer? Out of a sort of hope that he would bear the torture unflinchingly and perhaps refuse to die, proving the power and the strength of the human spirit, the reality of the human will? We can see that Merkulov killed himself for precisely the same reason that he killed Ivan Kirillich, out of a sense that life had lost all meaning. It's this that explains why so many murderers become suicidal. One third of all murderers commit suicide, and also why they often experience a compulsion to confess. The murder leaves him with a sense of living in a vacuum, cut off from other people and from the meaning of life. Confession, even if it brings life imprisonment or death, restores him to his place in human society. It's impossible to understand the psychology of the murderer without understanding how far all animals are possessed by the herd instinct. In nature, this is often so powerful that it completely overrules the instinct of self-preservation. A typical example was described by the naturalist Eugene Marais. A troop of baboons lived in a high, inaccessible cave in a cliff. One evening, before they had left their feeding place, a leopard cut off their retreat to the cave and prepared to attack. Two male baboons edged above it on the cliff and then dropped on it simultaneously. One bit its spine, the other tore at its throat from below. Within seconds, the leopard had killed both of them, but the baboon at its throat had reached the jugular vein and killed it. This kind of incredible self-sacrifice is part of the herd instinct. Not killing your own kind is equally a part of the instinct, except perhaps in fights to establish dominance or to secure a particular female. When men moved together into cities, this old tribal impulse was distorted and weakened. The herd unity was lost. Murder ceased to be a rarity, but it still affronts something deeply instinctive in human beings, as well perhaps as some higher impulse to evolution. Another vital piece of this puzzle was discovered by the sociologist Emile Durkheim. He wrote a remarkable study on suicide. It was almost a casual observation. After classifying suicides into various types, egoistic, men who feel little or no attachment to society, altruistic, those who commit suicide for the good of society, like Japanese suicide pilots, he goes on to mention a rather strange type, which he calls anomic or unnamed suicide. There's something absurd, paradoxical about this type. For example, we expect the suicide rate to rise during a period of economic depression, when many people are out of work. But it also rises during periods of prosperity, particularly before people have had time to get used to it. Sudden prosperity upset people as much as sudden tragedy. Human beings prefer to live rather narrow, habit-bound lives, like a canal flowing between its banks. If the banks disappear, they experience the same fear, the same sense of meaningless that Merkulov experienced after his first murder. The response to this meaninglessness is often suicide. The zoologist C.R. Carpenter observed the same dissolution of values when he had a troop of rhesus monkeys transported by sea to an island. On the ship, it was impossible to establish territory. They were confused and bewildered, and their usual herd instincts vanished. Males allowed other males to rape their wives, and mothers allowed their babies to die of starvation. Once on the island, they immediately established territory and reverted to normal. In short, the situation that produces anomic suicide can also produce all kinds of anomic action, including murder. In fiction, the man who has explored this situation more deeply than any other is the Russian novelist Dostoevsky. He was also fascinated by real murders. His writer's diary is full of notes on contemporary cases. A high proportion of Dostoevsky's characters commit murder or suicide because they feel alienation from society. They're in the basic anomic situation. They are outsiders. The most famous of them, Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, can only escape the burden of his guilt by confession and by doing penance in Siberia. He has to rediscover his sense of human solidarity. We can now see the answer to the question raised earlier. In what sense the robber who kills a policeman or the rapist who kills a girl is suicidal? The act of murder alienates a man from society and cuts him off from a sense of meaning. To have reached the mental state in which he can commit murder, he must already feel alienated, cut off from meaning like a diver with a blockage in his airpipe. The murder can only increase this alienation, pushing him closer to self-destruction. This also provides an interesting sidelight on a phenomenon that's always baffled criminologists, the compulsion to confess, the compulsion that makes innocent people go to the police and confess to murders that they never committed. We can now see that these are people who are already suffering from alienation, the feeling of meaning suffocation. Some deep instinct impels them to do what Raskolnikov does, to re-establish contact by confessing. It's an instinctive feeling that the way to escape the meaninglessness is by somehow drawing closer to society. They want to confess to something, anything, and if they have nothing to confess to, then they'll take someone else's crime and confess to that. Perhaps the most striking illustration of this intimate connection between suicide and murder is to be found in the case of the American mass murderer Karl Panzram, hanged in September of 1930. Panzram was an implacably antisocial type, with close resemblances to Vasily Makulov. When he died at the age of 39, Panzram had spent more than half his life in prisons, although never for murder. He was known as an extremely violent prisoner, and he spent much of his time in torture blocks and solitary confinement. In 1928, a young Jewish prison guard named Henry Lesser felt sorry for Panzram, and one day, after Panzram had been brutally beaten for some breach of discipline, Lesser sent him a dollar by a trustee. At first, Panzram thought it was a joke. When he realised that it wasn't, tears came to his eyes, and he told Lesser that he would write his life story for him. It's an interesting exemplification of the theory put forward by the American psychologist William Glasser that all human beings must have at least one person they relate to. Mental illness, says Glasser, occurs when a person cannot relate to anybody. But provided there's at least one person, it can be averted. Panzram, after a life of relating to nobody, suddenly seized his chance, not only of treating Lesser as a friend and an ally, but also of justifying himself to him by means of his confessions. Panzram's biographical notes are one of the most disturbing and important documents in modern criminology. When Panzram was executed for a murder committed in prison, Lesser tried to get them published, but they were so horrifying and brutally frank that no publisher would take them. It was not until 1970, in the wake of such studies as Capote's In Cold Blood, that they were finally published, edited by Thomas E. Gaddis and James O. Long, under the title Killer, A Journal of Murder. Panzram's life had been hard and violent. His father, a Minnesota farmer, deserted the family when Carl was a child. At 11, Panzram burgled the house of a well-to-do neighbour and was sent to reform school. He was a rebellious boy, and he was violently beaten. But he was also dominant and strong-willed, and so the beatings only deepened his desire to strike back at society. "Life being what it is, one dreams of revenge," said the painter Gauguin, and the words could be taken as the motto of Karl Panzram's life. Travelling around the countryside on freight trains, the young Panzram was sexually violated by four hobos. But the experience only deepened the rage against society and suggested a new method of expressing his aggressions. Panzram became a lifelong sodomite, and four of his victims were boys, whom he killed after raping. There's a typical passage describing how a brakeman caught Panzram and two other hobos in a railway truck. Panzram drew his revolver and committed sodomy on the man. Then he forced the other two hobos to do the same at gunpoint. It was his way of telling society what he thought of it. From then on, Panzram's life took on the pattern of a man beating his head against a brick wall. He was like some juvenile delinquent whose father beats him black and blue, and who then goes and does something even more outrageous by way of defiance, provoking another beating and still another act of defiance. In prisons, where he spent time for burglary, he was known as one of the most violent and intractable prisoners they had ever known. He was capable of screaming and beating the door all night, smashing every object in his cell, being punished until he was exhausted and unconscious, and then attacking the guard the moment he had enough strength to sit up. His incredible will drive had no object except to prove to the screws that he was untamable. There was a brief period when a kindly and sensible prison governor almost tamed him by allowing him freedom and treating him with sympathy, but it was too late. This freedom was an anomic situation that produced a sense of bewilderment and meaninglessness in Panzram. He ran away, was captured, and again thrown into solitary confinement. He was in his late 20s when he began to kill. He would pick up sailors, take them out to a stolen yacht, commit sodomy on them, kill them with a revolver and dump their weighted bodies into the sea. They're there yet, 10 of them. In Africa, he committed his first true sex crime, raping a Negro boy of 12 and then beating in his skull. After this, he hired a canoe with 6 Negroes, waited until they were in a remote place, and then shot them all in the back, throwing their bodies to the crocodiles and stealing the canoe. Significantly, he explained that his motive was to do people good, since human life was so vile that to murder somebody was to do them a favour. He liked to describe himself, ironically, as the man who goes around doing people good. The suicidal attitude already begins to appear, as in his remark, "I have seen all the world, and I don't like what I've seen of it. Now I want to get out of this damn world altogether." In America, Pantaram raped and killed three more boys, bringing his murders up to 20. After 5 years of robbery, rape, murder and arson, Pantaram was caught as he robbed the express office in Larchmont, New York, and sent to one of America's toughest prisons, Dannemora. "I hated everyone I saw." This becomes increasingly the theme of Pantaram's life. Like some stubborn child, he had decided to turn his life into a competition to see whether he could take more beatings than society could hand out, and his attitude had destroyed his potentialities as a human being. In Dannemora, he leapt from a high gallery, fracturing a leg, which was allowed to heal without proper setting, so that he limped for the rest of his life. He spent his days brooding on schemes of revenge on the whole human race, how to blow up a railway tunnel with a train in it, how to poison a whole city by putting arsenic in the water supply, even how to cause a war between England and America by blowing up a British battleship in American waters. It was during a period in jail in Washington, D.C. that Pantaram met Henry Lesser and began to write his autobiography. What's so interesting is that in spite of the paranoid fantasies of universal destruction, he instantly grasped at the chance of getting closer to one human being, of being able to confess everything to justify himself. And yet, like Vasily Merkulov, Pantaram knew that he was, in a sense, already dead. One day, Lesser came into his cell and checked the bars. Pantaram said in a low voice, "Never turn your back on me like that again." "But you wouldn't hurt me," Lesser objected. Pantaram agreed. "You're the one man in the world I don't want to kill. But I'm so erratic I might do anything." That is to say that, like Merkulov, his sense of values had been eaten away by his sense of meaninglessness. He had killed so often that he could not trust himself not to kill on a sudden perverse impulse. What is so moving, and in a sense so shocking, about Pantaram's diaries is that he is so obviously intelligent. He has a natural gift of self-expression. In his later days in jail, he read the German philosopher Schopenhauer and his fellow countryman Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. Significantly, it was after he met Lesser and had written most of his life story that he murdered the foreman of the working party with an iron bar, as if determined not to go on living. When Lesser held out hopes of a reprieve, perhaps even getting Pantaram freed on parole, Pantaram wrote with cool self-knowledge, "I would not get reform if the front gate was opened right now and I was given $1 million when I stepped out. I have no desire to do good or to be good." And in another letter he comes even closer to the heart of the matter. "I could not reform if I wanted to. It has taken me all my life so far, 38 years of it, to reach my present state of mind. In that time I have acquired some habits. It took me a lifetime to form these habits, and I believe it would take more than another lifetime to break myself of these same habits, even if I wanted to." He set out determinedly to die. He demanded to act as his own advocate in court, and was enraged when this was refused. Obviously, he wanted a last chance to confess publicly. After he was sentenced to death, he heard that an anti-capital punishment society was agitating for a reprieve, and he wrote them a letter telling them firmly that he didn't want a reprieve and to mind their own business. When he thought he might not be executed, he brooded on suicide. But his wish was granted, and he was hanged on September the 5th, 1930. For 40 years after his death, Pantaram was forgotten. And then suddenly he was recognised as one of the most important and interesting figures in 20th century crime, comparable to the Dusseldorf sadist Kürten, whom he resembles in many ways. The reason is paradoxical, not because his crimes were so appalling, compared with some later killers, they were almost humane, but because Pantaram, after a lifetime of destruction, finally turned his intelligence towards its real purpose, the act of creation. His letters and autobiography remain a remarkable monument to the indestructibility of human intelligence and honesty. A man with Pantaram's intelligence and determination was intended by nature to evolve. Society frustrated him, so his creativity turned to destruction. It was an appalling waste of human potential, and at the same time a proof that such waste can very often produce the urge to self-destruction.